Today on Against the Grain, what are the best means that we have to affect lasting social change? My guest today contends that even when progressive candidates are elected to positions of power, their achievements are constrained by the ability of the business class to disinvest in the economy in protest. Historian Kevin Young argues that, nonetheless, the left has a powerful tool to make change possible through mass disruptive action targeting the business class. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The obstacles to making fundamental change, such as that which is demanded by the climate emergency, can often seem insurmountable. Politicians are beholden to business interests that actively resist even small reforms. Even when progressive politicians are elected, their ability to make change can be minimal. But there are other ways to force through change, as history shows. Such history is detailed in Levers of Power, How the 1% Rules and What the 99% Can Do About It, co-authored by Kevin Young, Tarun Banerjee, and Michael Schwartz, and published by Verso Books. Kevin Young is Associate Professor of History at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. When I spoke to him recently, I asked him about how much power the broad public has in shaping the politics of the U.S. government. This was his reply.
Well, under normal circumstances, we don't have very much at all. Of course, the typical picture that we're presented in elementary school, middle school, and onward, and you know, in the corporate media every day, is that it's the electorate that determines what the politicians do, and that politicians are generally responsive to public opinion. And if you look systematically at the issues, though, and if you compare public opinion with public policy, there's an enormous gulf between those two. And it's a systematic gulf. So on issue after issue, people who are not in the upper 10 or 20% of the population have virtually zero statistical influence over the shape of government policy. And, you know, if we look, just take healthcare, for instance, an overwhelming majority of Democratic voters support the idea of Medicare for all. And even a majority of the population at large, Republicans included, also support Medicare for all. But it's nowhere to be found in the platforms of the two major parties. So on an issue that is of central importance to so many people in the country, everyone in the country, in fact, the shape of public policy is dramatically out of step with what the popular will is. And that issue, we could take that issue and generalize across the board. Environmental policy, the way that the government treats Wall Street and the financial sector, foreign policy, the government's actions and policies in all of these areas are dramatically and systematically out of step with what the population at large wants. And the only way under normal circumstances to bring the government into alignment with the popular will is through disruption. So what we talk about in the book is some of the ways that social movements over the course of the past century in the United States have successfully organized collective disruption, which brings to a halt the normal operations of businesses and banks and other dominant institutions. And by doing so, they're able to achieve some level of democratic responsiveness at the level of government policy.
And we'll talk a lot more as we go on about the arguments that you and your co-authors are putting forward in terms of the way that you think people should try and influence the policies and shape the policies of the country. But I wanted to ask you why the state of affairs that we have right now, why that is the case. You argue that the power of business elites doesn't simply come from their ability to, in effect, buy politicians by donating to their campaigns. We often hear that as an explanation, or revolving doors, that business elites and political elites are in the same cultural world, and therefore when somebody from business ends up in politics or vice versa. They do things that scratch the backs of people in business. But you say this is not sufficient. So tell us, from where does the power of the business class originate politically?
Corporate power is ultimately rooted in the control that corporations have over the economy itself. So just by virtue of owning the capital and controlling the investments on which the economy depends, corporations and banks are able to wield a lot of political leverage. So yes, they use campaign donations, they lobby, they try to put their people into government, you know, the so-called revolving door, and all of those tools are part of the standard corporate toolkit for influencing government, getting what they want from government. But there's also this control that comes from the very structure of our economy and the way that it's organized. Politicians depend on private investors to invest in the economy, to hire people, to provide essential goods and services. And if the private owners of those goods and services and capital refuse to invest, then the economy is going to be in deep trouble. And politicians know that. All politicians know that they need to maintain a certain level of employment, for instance, if they want to get reelected. So what this means is that even if a politician is not directly beholden to corporate power through campaign donations or lobbying and so on, they're still going to have to do something to appease capitalists so that capitalists continue to invest their money in the economy, because that's what the smooth functioning of the economy depends on, is the continual investment and flow of that capital. And in a highly unequal society in which wealth is mostly owned by private actors, those private owners and controllers of wealth and investment capital are going to wield extraordinary leverage. So we argue in the book that that's really the foundation of corporate power, and that these other weapons that they use, such as campaign donations, are really supplementary or complementary to that power that they have over investment capital.
Well, let's talk about some examples of that power and the ability to withdraw investment as a key lever, as your title would have it, in the business class's power over politics. You write about the Obama administration, which, of course, when Obama came to power, he promised all sorts of progressive policies on healthcare, on climate change, on reining in the banks. And even though he had widespread public support, and even though in his first 2 years in office he had the ability to get such things passed, he didn't. Tell us why.
Well, we look at three major examples from the early Obama era. One is healthcare, the Affordable Care Act. Another is financial reform, and his environmental policy. And you're right that in each of those areas, Obama, the candidate, had promised far-reaching changes, far-reaching progressive changes, which he knew were popular among the electorate. So in each of these policy areas in 2008, major change was on the ballot, and a large majority of the U.S. population, in every case, a majority of the U.S. population, favored major progressive change. That is, change that would rein in the power of the dominant corporations in each of those sectors, in the healthcare sector, on Wall Street, and the fossil fuels companies. But in every case, we see the same pattern, that the Obama administration bent over backwards to try to placate corporate power. And as a result, the Affordable Care Act, the Wall Street Reform Act in 2010, and Obama's environmental policies ended up being very business friendly and totally out of step with what the U.S. public actually wanted. And if we look at each of those three examples, we see similar patterns. The Obama administration and Congress put together policy reform legislation, and in order to do so, it went to the key players in those industries. So it invited in the pharmaceutical giants and the insurers and the hospital associations and the medical providers, the medical device companies, all of these key entrenched interests in the healthcare sector, brought them to the table from the beginning and offered them, gave them priority access to the policymaking process from the very beginning of the congressional deliberations that resulted in the Affordable Care Act in 2010. So from the very beginning, there was a severe compromise that was made. The Obama administration was signaling that no legislation is going to be successful without the consent and the enthusiastic consent of these various corporate interests. And anything that we change, say, for instance, the prohibition on insurers barring people with pre-existing conditions, which the insurers didn't like. But if we put that in the legislation, then we're going to have to compensate them somehow. And the way that the Obama administration did that with the ACA was, well, we're going to force everyone to buy private insurance. So that's going to compensate the insurers for this provision about pre-existing conditions that they don't like. So the Obama administration and Congress entered into a series of complicated negotiations with all the different corporate healthcare sectors, which to some extent they shared interests, but they also had slightly different interests. The pharmaceuticals didn't have precisely the same interests as the hospitals. The hospitals didn't necessarily have all the same interests as the insurers. But what emerged from the ACA was a recipe for reform that basically made everyone happy, or at least didn't make anyone so unhappy that they were going to oppose the legislation. But who got left out of this this grand reform proposal were the patients and were workers. People who didn't have access to the halls of power, who don't own capital, who, you know, live from paycheck to paycheck and struggle to pay their medical bills. So those people were essentially sacrificed. So in spite of the fact that the Affordable Care Act did entail some improvements that benefited patients, like the pre-existing conditions provision and some of the subsidies for patient care, the overall result of that negotiation was an outcome that was extremely favorable to the corporate healthcare sectors and other segments of corporate power. And if we look at the other cases from the Obama years, we see a very similar pattern. And I would say it's especially stark when we look at environmental policy. The Obama administration never succeeded in passing a major climate reform bill, despite the fact that that had been part of Obama's campaign promise. In 2008, when he was accepting the Democratic nomination for president, he famously predicted that that would be the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal. And if we look back on the record of the Obama years, it's something very different. And we are, of course, facing an escalating environmental catastrophe and human catastrophe every day, as I'm sure I don't need to tell people who are living on the West Coast right now.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Kevin Young. He is a historian and co-author of Levers of Power, How the 1% Rules and What the 99% Can Do About It. That's published by Verso. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. One of the things you also note in writing about the Obama years is that not only do business elites have outsized interests that are deeply embedded in the society itself and therefore allow them to have this outsized influence on policies that are adopted or are not, but that there are also other elites beyond business elites who wield power. Can you talk about that and talk about the example of the closing of Guantanamo, which Obama had promised he would close, obviously where inmates were tortured?
Right. So the closure of Guantanamo Bay, this prison camp that the United States has maintained on Cuban territory was another one of Obama's major campaign promises. He vowed to close the Guantanamo torture camp. This was a central promise of his campaign, in fact, a central part of his foreign policy promises, the image that he was trying to present to the public and to the world as someone who would be more committed to peace and respect for the peoples of the world than the George W. Bush administration had been. But when Obama came to office, he very quickly realized that it wasn't all up to him, that the Pentagon in particular had essentially a veto power over that policy, that if Guantanamo Bay was going to be closed, the Pentagon would have to give its consent. Local law enforcement officials and politicians from around the country in the cities and states would also have to give their consent if some of the prisoners were going to be transferred to the mainland United States. So this was a stark illustration of the way that certain government institutions within the state also have the ability to thwart policy reforms that aren't to their liking. So the Pentagon is really the most important of those state institutions, and we see again and again the way that the military exercises power over policy, despite the fact that we theoretically have civilian control over the military. We also see an enormous degree of influence exercised by law enforcement agencies, from local and state police departments to the Border Patrol to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The principle of civilian control is largely a fiction in that each of these institutions and their leaderships exercises control over the implementation of policy on the ground. So if they don't get on board with the policy changes that a politician who's been elected is trying to push through, it's going to be very hard for that politician to actually enact their campaign promises. And the example of Guantanamo Bay is, I think, a clear example.
And you write also that it's not simply the passage of policies, but also, for reasons you've just hinted at, their implementation that is part of these structural impediments to social change. And I wonder if you can talk about that, both the difficulties in implementing policies and then also the implementation of policies that might be the result of hard fought for struggles, but then that become eroded with time.
Yeah, so we argue in the book that the implementation phase of policy is at least as important as the actual passage of the legislation in Congress. I think that we are accustomed to thinking about the congressional phase as being the most important, that once a law is on the books, then, you know, it's effectively the reality. It's effectively the rules that are going to govern people's behavior. And that's really not the case, or it's often not the case, that just because a law is on the books doesn't mean it's going to be actually implemented in practice. Again, if we go back to the early part of the Obama administration, I'll give you just one example. The 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, Obama's big stimulus bill that he signed into law in early 2009, just after he came into office. Remember, this was in the midst of a devastating recession. And Congress had passed the legislation, and Congress had deliberated over whether the funding, the stimulus funding, was going to be subject to environmental regulations. So there was a debate about whether this landmark environmental law, the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, would apply to the subsidies that the government was handing out to private business. And there was a big debate in Congress, but eventually the Congress actually decided to include the environmental regulations. So the law as passed by Congress included those environmental protections. But what the Obama administration did when it was time to actually implement the law, the Obama administration, as the executive branch in charge of implementation, made the unilateral decision to basically exempt almost all of the stimulus money from these environmental protections. 96% of the stimulus money was exempted from the environmental protections under the 1969 law. And the process itself by which those exemptions was given was very interesting, that the contractors themselves who are receiving the federal money were given the ability to judge for themselves whether they wanted to be subject to the environmental protections. And, you know, you can imagine what their answer was. You know, no private business is going to willingly consent to government regulations if they have a better option. So that's one example of how implementation turns out to be very important. Now, it doesn't always turn out that way. And when you have a disruptive mass movement that is capable of influencing the shape of policy implementation, things can actually turn out in a much more positive way. So in the latter part of the book, we look at a few examples of very powerful social movements from the last century in the United States, and the ways in which they were able to shape the implementation of policy.
Can you tell us about the example of the Wagner Act, also known as the National Labor Relations Act of 1935?
Sure. So the Wagner Act in 1935 was about the right of private sector workers to unionize. It officially granted the right of workers in the private sector to form unions and to engage in collective bargaining, which was a huge legislative achievement. But when it was passed in 1935, it remained just on paper. It wasn't actually enforced for several years after that. And in fact, even after the Supreme Court upheld the law in 1937, it still wasn't widely implemented. And the reason it was eventually implemented by the late 30s, early 1940s, was that there was an incredible upsurge in worker disruption in the form of strikes and work stoppages and other job actions all over the country. Thousands and thousands of strikes. People may be familiar with the great sit-down strike in Flint in 1936-1937, which forced General Motors to recognize the United Auto Workers Union. So that was one example of how worker action on the shop floor was necessary to actually force the implementation of collective bargaining rights for workers and their unions. And then the other auto giants, Chrysler and Ford, followed within the next several years, and the auto industry kind of set the tone for the rest of the private sector in the United States. And what was especially interesting here is that you had private sector employers who had previously been dead set against workers in their shops organizing, actually changing their minds by the end of the decade or the start of the 1940s and inviting in the National Labor Relations Board into their places of employment and saying, come in here and preside over a union election. So this was totally unimaginable from the standpoint of the early 1930s. If you look at employers like Ford, Henry Ford was notoriously anti-union, in addition to being a Nazi sympathizer and everything else. By the early 1940s, you have employers all across the country who are actually reaching out to the federal government and embracing this new legislation that they had previously fought against tooth and nail. And the key change during that interim period of the mid to late 30s was this incredible upsurge in shop floor militancy by workers. And it really convinced employers like Ford and GM and Chrysler that accepting the unionization of their workers was the lesser of two evils. That either they could continue with this endemic disruption in their workplaces, with all of the danger to their profit levels, or they could accept the union and allow the union to represent the workers in the hope of restoring some degree of stability and profit making. So the movement of workers in that case forced the 1% into a choice between a greater evil and a lesser evil. And the lesser evil became consenting to the unionization of their workers. And the way that they were able to force that upon the employers was through disruption. It was not through the ballot box. So FDR and the Democrats were firmly in control of the government by the mid-1930s, by the time that the Wagner Act was being implemented. But it still remained on paper. The act wasn't being effectively enforced in workplaces around the country, even though Democrats controlled the presidency and the Congress and the courts. So worker activism was the key variable that was necessary to bring about its implementation.
Give us some other examples of successful mass disruptive movements that have targeted the business elite rather than politicians directly or focusing on elections.
I think one of the best examples comes from the early 1960s in the civil rights movement. And most people have seen the iconic photographs or video images of dogs and fire hoses being deployed against protesters in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963. This confrontation in Birmingham in the spring of 63 was arguably the most pivotal moment in the entire civil rights movement, in that it led to the introduction of civil rights legislation, which the Kennedy administration had been very reluctant to introduce, and a year later led to the passage of the Civil Rights Act, and then a year after that, the Voting Rights Act. But if we look at the way that the movement in Birmingham actually wielded so much power, the answer is actually quite different than the conventional narrative. The conventional narrative is that nonviolent protesters in Birmingham, through their disciplined nonviolence and unwillingness to be provoked by white supremacists and the violence that they deployed against them, the protesters were able to persuade the liberal white majority in the North, including the liberal Northern Democrats, to threaten federal intervention in Birmingham. And by so doing, by convincing people, by winning that moral argument about the virtue of their cause, they were able to defeat the white supremacist power structure in Birmingham. So that conventional narrative places a lot of importance on the ability of the movement to win over the white majority, particularly in the North. But if we look more closely at how the movement actually succeeded in April and May of 1963, the story is very different. And here we draw a lot on the work of sociologist Alden Morris, who wrote a great book in the 1980s called The Origin of the Civil Rights Movement. And he focuses a lot of attention on Birmingham. And so we draw from his research and kind of complement it with some of our own as well. And what we found is that the movement in Birmingham succeeded because it was able to disrupt economic power centers in Birmingham itself, namely the downtown merchants and the folks who comprised the Chamber of Commerce in Birmingham. They were the ones who eventually came around in late April or early May and told the mayor and the police and the city politicians to back off, stop repressing the movement, stop arresting people, stop enforcing segregation, stop committing violence against protesters. So it was remarkably the head of the Chamber of Commerce in Birmingham, a guy named Sidney Smyer, who was the leader of the negotiations with the movement. And he was the one pressing the rest of the white power structure in Birmingham to make concessions to the movement. And the reason was that all of his constituents were losing money. The downtown merchants had lost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And all of the sit-ins and the boycotts and the disruptive marches through the downtown had created an economic crisis for the 1% in Birmingham. So they ended up being the force that was most ready to make a deal with the movement, whereas the police and the mayor and others remained intransigent until the end. It was only the pressure from the economic power holders in Birmingham that brought them around and got them to consent to a deal with the protesters. And the organizers and strategists in the civil rights movement, they understood this very well. And they conscientiously adopted this strategy of targeting the centers of economic power in downtown Birmingham in order to get those people to put pressure on the political power structure. And the thinking was that they could change the political power structure by putting pressure on the economic power structure. So Martin Luther King Jr. Basically said exactly that a few months later, where he talked about how the political power structure listens to the economic power structure. So it makes sense as a social movement that doesn't have much political influence, target the economic power structure, and that's a way of getting the political power structure to change course. And I think that this example is really interesting because if we think about the recent black-led protests against police violence, this is the example of Birmingham potentially holds a lot of lessons for the current movement. The way in which protesters in Birmingham were able to exercise political leverage, including over the police, because the police were the main enforcers of that white supremacist terror regime in Birmingham. But the movement was able to defeat them, at least to a great extent, to rein in their power and force them to stop enforcing segregation. And I think that the current movement against police violence could learn a lot from this example of Birmingham in 1963.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by Kevin Young. He is co-author of Levers of Power, How the 1% Rules and What the 99% Can Do About It. That's published by Verso, and he's Associate Professor of History at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Well, you were speaking about the civil rights movement, the Black freedom struggle, and looking back, a lot of attention is paid to the role of the Supreme Court in the civil rights movement. And of course, with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, there's been enormous attention paid recently to the Supreme Court and the balance of power on the Supreme Court. Putting aside for now the larger question of whether the Supreme Court is a reactionary institution and undemocratic, how you make sense in thinking historically as you do about mass disruptive protests, the way that the Supreme Court has been the target of so much of the energies of progressives?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not going to say that it doesn't matter who's on the Supreme Court. It does matter to some extent, but it matters more what people are doing to put pressure on the institutions of government. So if we think about the civil rights movement, we go back to 1954 with the famous Brown versus Board of Education decision, which was about the desegregation of schools in the South. That was not enforced for a long time after 1954. It was only in the confrontation in Little Rock, Arkansas, that started the enforcement of that decision. But even after 1957 in Little Rock, there really wasn't effective implementation of school desegregation for years and years after that in most of the South. So that's another example of where the decision of the Supreme Court is not necessarily the key variable. It's not necessarily the key factor that transformed things. What it took for that school integration to be enforced was this very obstreperous, disruptive mass movement in the South, targeting in particular economic power centers. And it's really that movement that brought about the legal integration of schools. Now, whether schools are actually racially integrated today is another matter, but at least on paper, they're supposed to be. I think that another telling fact here about school integration is that we might associate school integration with the work of Democratic Northern politicians in the 1960s, JFK and Lyndon Johnson and others. But Richard Nixon's administration, this Republican, right-wing Republican at the time, actually desegregated more public schools in the southern United States than Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson combined. So that's a very stunning indication of the limits of Democratic politicians and their ability to actually bring change on the ground. So the reason why Nixon desegregated so many more schools wasn't that he was an anti-racist or that he was morally convinced by the arguments of the movement or the heroism of civil rights protesters. The reason is that when he came into office in 1969, he inherited a set of institutions and laws that ran contrary to his political goals. So he was, in effect, handcuffed by those institutions. So only as a result of these very disruptive movements led by black protesters over the course of the 60s, which continued after 65, by the way, it was only as a result of those movements continuing on through the Nixon administration that the Department of Justice and other institutions within the federal government were actually empowered and emboldened to enforce the law that had been on the books, and including the Supreme Court ruling of 1954. So Nixon ended up inheriting all of these institutions that were opposed to his own beliefs, but he couldn't do much of anything about it. So that's an example of the power of movements to, in effect, negate the will of the people who are in office. And you know, there are other examples of the Supreme Court and its limited power as well. I mentioned the Wagner Act, 1937. The Supreme Court actually endorsed. It upheld the Wagner Act of 1935, but even then, it was still a dead letter. It wasn't implemented until workers took up the baton and actually forced their employers to come around and accept the law. So the Supreme Court, you know, what the Supreme Court argues and rules on is important, and it's important to. You know, we can have somewhat better people on the court than others, and that's going to be helpful. I mean, certainly a Ginsburg is going to be better than a Scalia or a Clarence Thomas. But what ultimately matters more and what we have the power to influence ourselves is what we in the streets and the workplaces are going to be doing about it to force politicians and other government personnel to give us what we need.
In recent years, there's been a turn to elect progressive or even socialist politicians, obviously Bernie Sanders being the most prominent. Since you seem to be saying that the most important factor is mass disruptive protests, but also that on some level often can be paired with legislation that those protests either force through or make sure is upheld, what do you think of this strategy of trying to elect left-wing politicians? Is this energy that could be better spent on other things, or would this be something that could dovetail with what you're saying?
I've never been especially engaged in electoral activism. I did do some door knocking for Bernie Sanders earlier this spring, but you know, I'm certainly not opposed to having more progressive Democrats or socialists or other third-party candidates in office. And I think that they can do some real good. You know, if we look at examples from Seattle, for instance, Gashama Sawant has, you know, done some very interesting and progressive things on the city council in Seattle. And, you know, certainly having Bernie Sanders in the Senate is a good thing, or having AOC or Ilhan Omar in the Congress, that's, you know, that allows progressives to project a broader message that wouldn't normally reach the same number of people in the U.S. public. And it may also result in winning some legislative gains. But I would be cautious about assigning too much weight to the power of those individual progressives in government. Even if we succeed in electing those progressive candidates, they continue to be enormously hamstrung, enormously constrained by their institutional environment and by the need to keep the traditional corporate and institutional power holders satisfied. So I think that the electoral strategy, in the absence of a mass movement that can actually disrupt business as usual, it's destined to disappoint us if that's the way that we're trying to achieve change. I think that the progressive elected officials can be a complement to a disruptive mass movement, but we shouldn't focus the bulk of our energies on trying to build electoral campaigns. We should focus on building those disruptive mass movements that can target corporations and target state institutions directly. And once we build that mass movement, then the electoral campaigns will sort of emerge naturally out of that movement. So I think that that's where our ultimate focus should be.
I'm speaking with historian Kevin Young, co-author of Levers of Power: How the 1% Rules and What the 99% Can Do About It. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. One thing that we haven't really discussed so far that you write about with your co-authors in Levers of Power is that when we talk about targeting the elite and creating mass movements, mass disruptive movements that can focus on the business class and others, that there are divisions amongst elites that could be exploited. Can you give us some examples of how mass disruptive movements have played upon those divisions in the past?
Sure. Well, to go back to the example of Birmingham, that's a case where there was a clear separation between some of the economic power holders in Birmingham and the rest of the political power structure. And it was the mayor and the police and others who remained the most intransigent. But that division within the elite sectors in Birmingham didn't just magically materialize. It was something that the movement actually created and fostered and split wide open. So the movement was really responsible for fostering that division and using that division to its advantage. But it did rely on a calculation by the movement that the merchants in the downtown area would be the most likely to come around and favor concessions to the movement. So the movement organizers decided that, look, we're excluded from political power. We don't even have the right to vote here. But what we do have is our economic power as consumers and our power as protesters in the streets to actually impede the flow of traffic and the flow of consumers, both black and white. And if we can use that collective power, then we can create this split between the economic elite and the political elite in Birmingham. So that's, I think, a good example of how a movement has not just taken advantage of a split within the elite, but also helped to foster that split from the beginning. If we look at other examples more close to our own present today, there are some interesting examples actually from the Trump administration. The Trump administration has been a catastrophe on so many levels, in human terms and in ecological terms. But there are some interesting cases in which the Trump administration has been constrained by its own environment. And including by corporations and institutional resistance to its some of its most reactionary policy initiatives. So one example is when Trump tried to open more of the offshore waters off the coast of the U.S. to oil drilling. And he essentially tried to open all of the coastal waters to oil drilling by oil companies. And this plan surprisingly met with a lot of resistance from certain sectors of the corporate elite, namely the tourist and seafood sectors that relied on having a viable coastline that wasn't being constantly disrupted by oil spills. So the tourist industry in places like Florida, for instance, and some of the other southeastern states, actually opposed his plan to open more of the coastal waters to drilling. So that was an example where there was a division within the elite, and there was some pushback from certain sectors of corporate America to the fossil fuel industry agenda as embodied by the Trump administration. In that particular case, there wasn't necessarily a major social movement that was directly agitating and pressuring around that. Another example of how even under the Trump administration, this narcissistic and authoritarian administration that is dedicated to serving corporate interests above all else, there was nonetheless this interesting split occasioned by one of the Trump administration's initiatives. And it provides a clue about some of the openings that could be exploited by social movements in the future.
Well, let me end by asking you about the climate crisis, which, however the election goes, the climate crisis is escalating and action needs to be taken, and yet there has been consistent inactivity by elites to stop it. Obviously, just as you flagged, one can think of various different divisions of interest amongst the business class. Also, fossil fuel companies clearly have different interests than the insurance companies. How would you think a strategy of mass disruptive protests should look like around the climate crisis?
Well, that's really the million-dollar question for me, and I'm afraid I don't have a terribly specific answer to offer, but the principle that I think our movement should focus on is the need to make the status quo intolerable to the 1%. So if we're thinking about any aspect of our current status quo, whether it's the devastating wildfires on the West Coast, or it's the pandemic that we're experiencing, or it's any other crisis that we as a society need to confront, the most effective way that we have for confronting that emergency is to make the people who matter in the halls of government feel the pain from that crisis. Make them feel the pain from the status quo so that they can use their power, so that they are forced to use their power to actually address the problem in a way that meets the needs of the society as a whole. So I think that we need, as a movement or as a coalition of movements interested in preserving a livable earth and protecting the people and other living things that depend on the earth, we need to be thinking more seriously about how to inflict direct pressure and direct costs on not just the fossil fuels industry, although they're, of course, the main target, but also the other industries that maybe don't have such a direct stake in the preservation of the fossil fuels industry's profits, who could be enlisted as potential counterweights to the power of the fossil fuels companies. I think we need to think creatively here about the ways that workers can use their leverage to force changes in corporate policies. In my union here in Massachusetts, we've recently started bargaining over climate issues, which goes well beyond the standard list of things that unions bargain over, but trying to force our employer, the University of Massachusetts, to adopt much more robust energy efficiency standards and cut down on its fossil fuels consumption, and also sever ties with some of the financial institutions and companies that are contributing to the environmental catastrophe. We need to think about how we can use our role as consumers. The boycott is an incredibly effective weapon. It was the the preeminent weapon of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, but it's one that we don't often associate with the civil rights movement. But it's a very effective weapon if used carefully and if it's done in a really organized way. I think that the strategy that we choose depends on our location in the power structure. Different groups of us, you know, whether we're workers or consumers or students, we all have particular means of leverage that we can bring to bear to confront this emergency. And we need to be thinking creatively about how we can do that collectively in a way that goes beyond just trying to elect Joe Biden or trying to elect other Democrats, but that actually inflicts costs and inflicts real economic pain on the 1% in society, because they're the ones who, at least under our current structure of our economy and our government, they're the ones who have the power to actually change things.
Kevin Young, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Kevin Young is co-author with Taryn Banerjee and Michael Schwartz of Levers of Power, How the 1% Rules and What the 99% Can Do About It. That's published by Verso at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. He's associate professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and also the author of Blood of the Earth, Resource Nationalism, Revolution, and Empire in Bolivia. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.